are not yet on. I'm not sure if Ed is successfully on, but let's get started, and hopefully they will get on. So welcome everyone to the seventh meeting of the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel. Thank you all very much for joining us and sticking with us through this this process. It's great to see everyone here. Great to have sort of continued participation, not just of our panel members, but of members of the public. I see that there is, looks like a growing list of attendees on this meeting. So it's this is one of the benefits of being virtual in this virtual world is we can have so many folks join us. So I'm glad to see everyone here. Look forward to the input. We are getting close to having our recommendations together, so that input, that public input, is going to become is particularly critical now. We look forward to hearing from everyone. Thanks very much. So could we have the next slide, please? So before we get started, just wanted to remind panel members that to be on mute if you're not speaking. When you are speaking, just turn the mute off. You can raise your hand if you'd like to speak, or simply interrupt. We're a small enough group. Just go off mute and speak. And again, if this is for panel members, attendees, due to time and just logistics, we can't unmute you. But we do encourage everyone to enter comments into the chat if you have anything to add or anything that you'd like us to consider. Can we have the next slide? As I said, you can enter public comments into the chat now. During this meeting, you're also welcome to submit public input between advisory committee meetings using our email address, which is shown here on the slide. We really encourage you to do so. And Josh will talk a little bit more about what we've received so far, but this is a very good way for us to receive sort of thoughtful and written input that we can integrate into the recommendations as we develop them. Can I have the next slide, please? Okay, so before we get started, I'll just do a quick roll call. Starting with, I'll start with Mark Lowry.
I'm here.
Okay, thanks. Jessica Basher.
I'm here.
Is Jamie Burchard-Tillman on? Jamie, okay, well, hope Jamie will join us. Kevin, I did not see Kevin Law either. Kevin, did you join us?
I don't see Kevin or Jamie.
Okay. Let's hope they'll join us shortly. And Katie Malinowski?
Here.
Awesome. Ed Marks? I know Ed's here.
You might still be having some audio issues. We're working on it.
All right. So I'll say here on behalf of Ed. Kathy Mosher?
I'm here.
Hello. And Priya Mulgaonkar?
I'm here.
Gita Nadan?
Here.
And Juan Camillo Osorio? Did I see Juan?
I don't see him in the attendee list or the panel list yet.
Okay. Eric Walker? Oh, okay. Let's hope that, I'm sure that those folks will join us shortly, but let's get started anyway, reviewing the agenda. Can you give me the next slide, please? Thanks. So we have, at this meeting, we'll start as I said with the welcome and agenda. We're going to, Josh Hahn is going to give us a quick update on the public comments that we've received so far, just to give us an idea of, you know, just to give sort of an overview of what's coming in. Followed by that, we've been joined by Yvonne Martinez and Kara Allen to give us an overview of the Just Transition principles that were developed by the Just Transition Working Group. And we can, if anyone has any questions or wants to have any discussion on those principles and how we can integrate them into our recommendations, that's the time. Following that, we will get into our subcommittee updates and review where we are and all four of the subcommittees. There is, I noticed, it's totally my fault, but we're land use and carbon sequestration are flipped. So we'll do adaptation resilience, then carbon sequestration, then land use, then clean energy. And we'll sort of talk about where our recommendations are and where we're heading with the, we'll have much more built out recommendations, I think, at our next meeting. And then following that, we'll talk about next steps and wrap up some of the things that we need to cover at that point. Just quickly, are the upcoming public meeting, the local officials roundtable that's been scheduled for March 2nd, and some other sort of housekeeping, and talk about getting towards our final recommendations. So that is our agenda for today. Can I have the next slide, please? All right, so with that, I'm going to hand it off to Josh for the public input summary. Thanks, Josh.
Thanks, Sarah. In our public emails and chat comments, we've received about 65 comments so far, most via the chat function, which has proven to be a fairly popular way for the public to engage during our meetings. We're seeing increased levels of engagement around carbon sequestration, and that's due to the February 5th learning session and the creation of that subgroup within our panel. So that's great to see. And then just the note that public comments will continue to be compiled from both the inbox and our chat, and we provide those to our panel members on a weekly basis on our SharePoint site. And then you can see the pie chart is the breakdown of comments that we've received so far. So I'll hand it over now to Yvonne and Kara to talk to us about Just Transition.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Yvonne Martinez. Thank you all for inviting Kara and me to talk with you today on behalf of the Just Transition Working Group and our group's co-chairs, NYSERDA President and CEO Doreen Harris and the New York State Labor Commissioner Roberta Reardon. Just Transition Working Group established a set of principles to help guide all of the advisory panels in their collective pursuit of a just and equitable transition from fossil fuel-based economies toward the carbon-neutral future that's envisioned by the CLCPA. There are 10 principles, and our working group views them as serving in part to guide the advisory panel recommendations. Importantly, we acknowledge that each will have a different applicability depending on the economic sector or the scope of the advisory panel. These principles, they really are intended to be guideposts rather than mandatory or binding requirements. So again, that's an important distinction that we continue to emphasize. They should be top of mind as you're developing recommendations, but again, they're not mandatory. So before we walk through the principles, Kara's just going to give a little bit of background on how they actually came to be, how they were developed. Kara?
Thanks, Yvonne, and thank you to the advisory panel members for the chance to be with you today and to talk about this important work. So as Yvonne mentioned, I'm going to give you a little bit of a background as to how these principles came to be before we actually look at the principles themselves. The body of work wrapped up in the topic of just transition is pretty hefty, as I imagine a number of you are well aware. And it's hefty both in terms of just the amount of existing thought on the subject, but that thought is also very deep. And so taking on this topic can feel a little overwhelming. And that's where the concept of developing principles emerged. We wanted to provide a succinct set of, like Yvonne said, guiding principles that could lay out this concept in a manageable, digestible, but also in high-level terms. And so the principles you see will be reflective of that. The Just Transition Working Group agreed to review definitions, principles, and examples of just transition efforts in other jurisdictions and provided by other organizations, as we set about, as the group set about developing these principles. We also had an eye toward what would be applicable to New York State. New York is in a different position than some other jurisdictions may be. And so the working group was mindful of that fact in developing these principles. The state agency staff conducted research surveying more than 100 sources and finding over 300 examples of principles and definitions for consideration. The examples came from entities like nonprofits, think tanks, advocacy groups, academic papers, government bodies, and others. And this extensive work formed the basis of the principles that we will be walking you through and the language of those principles. So with that, I think we'll go to next slide. I'll hand it back to Yvonne.
Thanks, Kara. So as you can see, there are 10 principles, and I'm going to start with the first five, starting with the category, which you see here on the slide, and then I'll also share the associated and expanded language that builds out each of those categories. So our first category is stakeholder-engaged transition planning. And with this, our language is engage a diverse range of stakeholders via early inclusive engagement in communities' transitions to local low-carbon economies, including New York's workforce and the state's disadvantaged communities. Moving on to the second principle, collaborative planning for a measured transition toward long-term goals. And our principle language is encourage collaborative state and community-based long-term planning, capacity building, and robust social dialogue in order to ensure a gradual and supported transition. Our third category is preservation of culture and tradition. And our principal language is ensure that transition plans, policies, and programs reflect and respect local wisdoms, cultures, and traditions, including recognition of Indigenous sovereignty. Our fourth category is realize vibrant, healthy communities through repair of structural inequalities. And our principal language is seek to lift up New Yorkers in the transition to a low carbon economy by implementing transition policies and programs that promote cross-generational prosperity and gender and racial equity in recognition of the disproportionate burden of environmental pollution and climate change on disadvantaged communities. And our fifth category is equitable access to high-quality family-sustaining jobs. And our principal language reads, promote the creation of high-quality family-sustaining jobs, including union jobs, and ensure that new jobs are created in transitioning and disadvantaged communities, connecting workers to employment opportunities through career services, skills training, and infrastructure investments. And Kara will cover the next five principles.
Thanks, Yvonne. So picking up, the next principle is redevelopment of industrial communities, and the corresponding language is to promote diversified, strengthened economies in the transition to a low-carbon economy. Examine opportunities for community-centered ownership structures and promote industry recovery, retention, and growth for regions and sectors in transition. The next principle, development of robust in-state low-carbon energy and manufacturing supply chain. The language there reads, develop a robust in-state low-carbon supply chain spanning full product life cycles to increase focus on exporting low and no carbon products, and to ensure that jobs in these emerging sectors become more accessible to the local workforce and to disadvantaged communities. The next principle, climate adaptation planning and investment for a resilient future, integrate climate adaptation into transition planning, including through promotion of community resilience and investment in sustainable infrastructure. The next principle reads protection and restoration of natural and working land systems and resources. And language there, promote the restoration, conservation, and resiliency of the state's agricultural and natural systems, improving local food security and supply, and fostering healthy ecosystems, particularly in disadvantaged communities, through sustainable land and natural resource use. And finally, mutually affirming targets for state industrialization and decarbonization reads, implement decarbonization policies that simultaneously bolster industry retention and sustainable economic development and growth, and ensure that economy-wide programs and policies that address social, environmental, and economic challenges of workers and communities in transition. So again, that is the suite of the Just Transition Working Group's principles as provided to all of you for your consideration as you work on developing your recommendations for submission to the Climate Action Council. I'll pause there and hand the floor back to Sarah.
Thank you very much, Ivana and Kara. Does anyone on the panel have any questions or like any clarification about the Just Transition Principles while we still have Ivana and Kara on the line?
Yes, Sarah, it's Mark Lowry. Mm-hmm. I guess there's the tendency might be, and I realize that these are not requirements, but they almost form a checklist, and that the temptation will be there, I think, to look at our recommendations, run down a checklist of these 10 principles and say, yeah, we hit 8 or 9 of them, so we're good. And they end up, in the best of worlds, being just guideposts, if you will, rather than actually using what we are doing, using our recommendations to actually help achieve some of these the goals that are embodied in these principles. You know, not only do we ensure that the recommendations don't infringe upon a just transition, but that they actually enable a just transition. And maybe that's a bit of a nuance, but I'm wondering if how other groups are using these, and if there's any guidance on how we can use these in a more positive way than just as fodder for a checklist.
Mark, I think what you suggested is what certainly we would hope to have the panels doing, is to really think about these not just as a box checking exercise, but really to put forward recommendations that are advancing these various aspirational tenets. And part of the reason why they're aspirational is because, again, there's going to be different context for how they'll apply based on the advisory panel, and I know you know that well. We have been sharing these principles across other advisory panels. It's difficult. I can't say with certainty as to how each of them are thinking about them, but we have been doing, Yvonne and I have had a couple of these presentations to other advisory panels. And so we know that others are aware that these principles are there and are thinking about them, but how they're thinking about them, I think may be best answered by the panels themselves.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and I would just like to add, I think that having these principles written out is certainly encouraging and helpful, I think, for our panel as we evaluate the recommendations that we've, you know, for their applicability, these just transition principles. It's I think we've actually had on our panel a lot of these sort of general ideas in mind as the recommendations were being developed. So I know as we look at these, I think we'll see that we're really, we are maximizing our opportunity to try to get towards a just transition. So thank you very much for this.
Yeah, I want to thank you also. This is Gita speaking. And these are, I think, a great, I think, collection, and specifically for our group in terms of like land use and government, like I find some of these to be sort of really directly related to the work we're doing. I think one of the most critical ones is sort of the one that addresses structural inequalities. And I think that that almost seems to be maybe the hardest one on here. And I'm curious to see how our group sort of takes maybe that one back and looks at it more closely. That being said, you know, even with this set of just transition principles, my only concern is it doesn't necessarily mean that as we move forward, especially with the sort of issues around land use and access, that communities that are most directly impacted will sort of be the first and foremost locations or groups of people where we are sort of targeting our efforts. So I'm just wondering if there is a principle that you guys thought about that maybe sort of lifted EJ communities and said, like, these are the ones that are at the forefront of this and are really the ones most impacted and so forth, therefore, like, need to be always sort of put at the front of how we're distributing funds or how we're putting in our efforts, or, you know, sort of really being more specific around that. Maybe that doesn't, is that not clear? Does that?
Gita, I think what you're asking is, were you asking about specific, how directed are these toward EJ communities in particular?
I'm saying that to me, a principle is that, like, while these are principles, to me, a principle is that, like, those communities come first. Like, that we need to sort of say as a principle, like, we are targeting our efforts towards EJ communities that have been disproportionately affected for centuries. And so, you know, you could roll out all these principles and those communities could still be left out. Not one of these sort of says that has to be a part of our process.
This is Yvonne. I think the way I look at these principles, I feel like that the idea of bringing in those communities is actually woven into several of the principles that we have here. If you talk about, like, the stakeholder engaged transition planning, and we talk about you know, again, inclusive engagement specifically with respect to disadvantaged communities. When you talk about the idea that you want equitable access to high quality family sustaining jobs, again, we're looking specifically at disadvantaged communities. So I think what we've tried to do is weave it into many of these you know, of these principles. Again, you raise a good point, though. I don't know exactly for individual advisory panels how they're going to effectuate that in particular. I know, obviously, for our group, it's top of mind because we are the Just Transition Working Group. So everything that we do will be with an eye towards that. Yeah, and I think we can take what, you know, sort of take this in concert with the recommendations as well that will be coming out of the Climate Justice Working Group, that sort of more laser focused on identifying those communities, identifying, you know, what that means, what does, you know, where are the underserved communities, where are those communities that the disadvantaged communities that need to be the focus of, you know, of a lot of this investment. So I think, you know, we sort of want to look at this as part of the overall package and overall direction of the recommendations of the and that will come out of this, and of you know, the direction that we are receiving to help us frame our recommendations. Awesome. So I guess any other comments or questions for Kara and Yvonne? Okay, great. All right, thank you guys. Thank you both so much. Really appreciate you joining us and sharing the principles. And we will be looking at those closely as we refine the recommendations and sort of make determinations as to what moves forward and what doesn't. So thank you all again. Is there anything
for having us?
Thank you. All right. So let's move on now to sort of the heart of our meeting. Let's talk about the where we are with developing our recommendations. And can I have the next slide, please? All right. So so we will go through sort of each of the subgroups. I just wanted to start with this slide sort of in the list of the goals that are guiding our panel. Just as sort of this is where we turn back to. This is, you know, sort of where all of these recommendations are coming from, whether they're focusing on land use or local government's role in clean energy, carbon sequestration, or adaptation resilience. Just as a reminder, I like to put these up, but we can move on to the next slide now. So since our last meeting, what we're going to talk about today is built on what we talked about at our last at our February 1st meeting. Since then, I just wanted to highlight what has happened and what's informing this iteration of the recommendations. We've had subgroup meetings. The adaptation resilience subgroup meeting has met, the carbon sequestration, land use, and the clean energy subgroup. So we had subgroup meetings for all of the groups to reflect back on what we heard at the last meeting and also any other public input that we have received in the interim. There was also a great cross-panel learning session on carbon sequestration by forests and trees. I want to thank Laura Heady very much for organizing that. That was really interesting and informative. There have also been several staff working group meetings. We've also had some other cross-panel discussions to ensure that, you know, to share recommendations, to talk about where there's overlap and ensure that we're sort of working together to come up with ensuring that we're working together and acknowledging each other's recommendations and the directions that each of the panels is taking. Again, public comments were also received, as Josh talked about before, and will continue to be. We look forward to all of this ongoing. So let's look at this as sort of a check-in. This is where we are. We can, we're coming together, sharing where the subgroups are going, where the recommendations are, and we will then leave from this meeting and continue to work in our subgroups and with other panels to continue to develop and refine these recommendations. So with that, can I have the next slide, please? Terrific, I'd like to start. Let's start with adaptation and resilience. And I'm gonna hand things over to Mark Lowry to fill us in on where, sort of give an update on that, on the work of the adaptation resilience subgroup. So Mark.
Thank you, Sarah. Next slide, please. My intent today is to give a pretty brief progress update and to lay out our process and describe the schedule that the adaptation and resilience subgroup is on, because it is the development of the adaptation and resilience recommendations for presentation to the council is on a different timeline than the recommendations that are focused on mitigation. As Sarah mentioned, we last met the Adaptation Resilience Group met on February 4th and discussed what at the time were, I believe, four or five initiatives that we are going to recommend. Given that discussion, we've reorganized things and there are now 9 different initiatives. These are the first 4, and I'll show you the second 5 in a moment. Just to give you an idea, though, of the process that we're following, the 9 initiatives that I'm going to review very briefly today are what are being developed by the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel, or recommended to the panel itself. On the other hand, the other panels, the Climate Justice Working Group and the other 6 advisory panels that are focused on mitigation, and for that matter, the 3 subgroups that are part of the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel that are also themselves focused on mitigation, have been asked to think about adaptation and resilience considerations specific to the mitigation strategies they are recommending. And so what we're envisioning is that in about 3 or 4 weeks, we will be getting recommendations from these other advisory panels, as well, and integrating them with the recommendations that are being developed internally, if you will, to the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel. And I'll show you the specifics of that in a moment, but let me just quickly review how we are currently thinking about these initiatives. And I'm going to use the term initiative because that's what the council has asked us to recommend. And as the, I'm sure the members of the panel and the staff working groups that have been following this understand, that within each initiative, the expectation is that there will be a number of components. These slides that we're being asked to use, these slide templates, are broken into initiatives and components. And so I'm not going to talk about the components today, but we'll talk about those. I'll be talking about those at the staff level and involving the panel members over the next few weeks. And then by early March, members of the interested public will be able to see those and comment on them as well. And I'll go over again that schedule in a moment. So what we have now in terms of the initiatives is, the first is to commit to a comprehensive state climate change adaptation and resilience planning. New York State, as I've mentioned before, does not have a climate adaptation plan. And so a lot of stakeholders believe we actually need one to have less of an ad hoc approach to adaptation planning. The second is to ensure that all state funding and regulatory programs, projects, and updates include consideration of adaptation and risk reduction. That there would be, we know that most adaptation work and certainly the effects of climate change are felt most directly at the community level. And so we are going to prioritize providing recommendations that relate to enhancing, providing technical and planning support for regional and local adaptation and resilience planning. They're coming, actually back, going back to the NYS 2100 Commission, there have been recommendations to take a hard look at the SEQRA itself, the State Environmental Quality Review Act, and its implementing regulations and procedures to ensure that future climate considerations, future climate conditions are considered during that process. And so we are going to be making recommending an initiative and components related to that. Next slide, please. We know that New York State has been hit probably hardest by flooding, and that is perhaps the most direct effect that New York State is going to experience, at least for a while, in terms of climate change, both inland riverine flooding and coastal flooding due to sea level rise, which consists includes enhanced coastal storms, but also gradual inundation. So we're going to prioritize providing recommendations related to continuing to try to reduce the impact of flooding. The same with thermal extremes. These are probably going to be focused on the impacts of heat on public health. There are certainly other thermal extremes, including extreme cold and effects on other sectors as well, that we need to be prepared for. But our thinking is that those will require more comprehensive long-term planning. And I guess what I should have said is that these some of these initiatives we are focusing on because we consider them to be no regrets kinds of options the state could follow that have been recommended in other venues and can be implemented without an awful lot of additional planning, whereas other adaptive and resilience options or alternatives probably entail more planning and will be addressed while we do a more if we implement the first initiative, which is to do a more comprehensive adaptation and resilience plan. So again, a lot of the recommendations related to flooding, thermal extremes, disruption of ecosystems really relate to things that we think are again, no regrets activities activities that can be taken while we are in the process of doing a more comprehensive adaptation plan. Disruption of ecosystems is really a follow-on effect of a host of primary and secondary climate change effects, whether it's extreme precipitation, sea level rise, drought, all these things, as everyone on the call is aware, can combine to disrupt native ecosystems, and we want to make some recommendations related to that. We will be making some recommendations regarding strengthening public understanding of climate change and its potential effects and potential solutions, and then figuring out how we actually support these kinds of activities, particularly through funding or other programs, and looking at the insurance sector to see how insurance can be used to strengthen our resilience here in New York as well. So those are the nine overall initiatives that are currently under consideration. Next slide, please. I'll go back and take questions in a moment. Next slide, please. So we are going to provide to the members of the land use and local, or I'm sorry, to the adaptation resilience group, which includes the members of this panel plus the associated staff, by close of business tomorrow, you will have access to a draft of the components of each of these nine initiatives that are being developed by staff right now. This is going to be very much a dynamic process where everyone who is involved at the staff and the panel level will have access to the SharePoint site. If you have not gotten information on the SharePoint site or had trouble accessing it, please let me know. But that essentially will be open, is open now for folks to make comment. We will meet on the 25th to begin the Adaptation Resilience Group will meet on the 25th to discuss those more detailed components of the initiatives. And again, on the 4th, what we're planning on the 25th is that we will review the components related to the nine initiatives I just reviewed on March 4th. We're asking the representatives, the liaisons from the other advisory panels to present on their work with regard to adaptation resilience considerations of their adaptation, or I'm sorry, of their mitigation strategies. There will be a public meeting, general public meeting, mostly focused on the mitigation strategies for this panel on the 8th. The Adaptation and Resilience Group will meet on the 15th of March with the idea of reviewing what I'm referring to as the integrated recommendations. So we're going to have these recommendations coming from the mitigation panels. We want many of them could be subsumed into the initiatives. We believe that the nine initiatives that we're focusing on right now, there may be room for additional work or additional initiatives, but we'll identify that during some integration process and ask this panel or the group to review it on the 15th. We're also scheduling a focus stakeholder session with adaptation professionals in early April. We are currently holding April 8th for a public meeting on the adaptation resilience recommendations specifically. By that time, recommendations will have for mitigation will essentially be ready to go to the council. So we will be on this delayed timeline for the adaptation and resilience recommendations, focusing our April 8th public meeting on those adaptation recommendations. And again, the group will meet on the 21st and recommending that the panel meet in early May. I don't think we've solidified this date, but I would recommend the 4th so that the panel itself can review through the final integrated adaptation and resilience recommendations before they're forwarded to the council for its consideration. We anticipate being asked to make a presentation to the council in early to mid-May, specifically on the adaptation resilience recommendations. So, have I left time for any questions or comments?
Yes, anyone have anything? Before, let me just say something quickly. First on the, I know this is the first everyone's seen of the meeting on the 4th. We can talk about that at the end of the meeting. We also, I know we've got a lot of meetings, but want to talk about another land use and local government advisory, full advisory panel meeting sometime in the last week of March. So just keep that all logistically on your radar as we get to the end. And now back to adaptation resilience. Anyone have any questions, comments, discussion for Mark?
Let me add, I'm sorry, we mentioned other meetings, and I know it has come up before that this group has talked about having a meeting regarding adaptation with the agriculture and forestry panel, and my plan is to work on scheduling that after we see the agriculture and forestry advisory panel's recommendations. We can talk then about more cogently about how to integrate them.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, and maybe at our next meeting, Mark, also we could just take those just transition principles and do just like a internal exercise of just going through point by point and seeing how those all might integrate or overlap. Not, I don't think we have to do that here, but I think it would be a good internal exercise to do.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you.
All right. Anything else on adaptation and resilience? All right. I'm glad we have a little bit of an extended timeline for that, because we do have a lot to get done in the next few weeks. It's nice to have a little bit of a breather. Okay. Let's move on to carbon sequestration, and I'll pass things off to Laura Heady, who's been leading that group. And this group, I just want to note that the carbon sequestration subgroup has been meeting, has not been meeting as long as the other two. And so we're, you know, on a sort of tight time frame there, but not as far along yet. So I'll hand it off to Laura.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. So I think you can go to the next slide, Josh. So I will just be giving a very brief update because our subgroup only started convening less than a month ago on January 25th. Feels like it's been a long month. But since that last panel meeting, as Sarah mentioned, we did have a public learning session on February 5th for the land use local government and the agriculture and forestry panels and the staff working groups on the benefits of trees and forests to mitigate climate change and increase carbon sequestration opportunities. We had our second work group meeting on February 8th. And kind of outside of those meetings, we're continuing to coordinate with the staff working group for the Ag and Forestry Advisory Panel on recommendations related to trees and forests. So we haven't really started developing those recommendations in our subgroup yet, because we're looking to really make sure there's a lot of synergy with theirs and not be too repetitive. We have started drafting recommendations and strategies specific to freshwater wetlands and blue carbon. Next slide. With emphasis on finding ways to maintain their sequestration potential in New York State. And so there'll be more on that as we develop the details and the recommendations and should be ready to share that at the next panel meeting. So I will keep it short and sweet and end there unless anybody has any questions.
Anyone have anything for Laura or any of the other panel members who've participated in any of the meetings? Want to add anything to that? Okay.
All right, well, thanks. And thanks to the folks from the panel who've been coming to those subgroup meetings, and you should have received something in your inbox yesterday for review.
All right, thank you so much, Laura. This is, look forward to the next iteration. Okay. And with that, can I have the next slide, please? I'd like to move on to the land use subgroup and this group of recommendations. As you all know, we've divided our panel up into these different subgroups. There is, of course, some overlap between the types of recommendations that we have and the different groups that we may be able to address as we get to sort of finalizing these recommendations. But this is sort of this division makes the most sense for being able to sort of bite off our task in manageable pieces. So you may see some overlap, but we will, this is just the best organizational way that we have found so far. So with that, let me hand things over to Paul Beyer, who is leading the land use subgroup effort for an update on where recommendations are with this group. Paul, you're on mute. I see you. There you are.
Okay, next slide, please. All right, we truncated, narrowed down some of these recommendations since the last time to make them a little more presentable to the Climate Action Council. But these are all familiar to you folks. You've seen them many times. We had a subgroup meeting earlier this week to freshen them up, and so there were some additions and revisions made since then. The countywide smart growth planning component and technical and financial support for priority development conservation areas is huge. It's front and center here. We narrowed that down a little bit into two sentences. We included mention of health impact assessments since health and health disparities are embedded in the statute. We felt that it was necessary to include them in our planning, and health impact analyses are their own little animal. They're different from seeker and environmental review, but they also are playing an increasingly critical role in planning and projects in disadvantaged communities. We narrowed down some of the case studies here. You'll see there's less words, but we still have a bunch of good case studies to model this program on. And stop me anytime if anybody, I can pause in between each slide if you'd like. And so here are the components. Again, you've seen them. We would like to get back to the original concept of the 2013 regional sustainability plans, but also infuse them or marry them with the REDC functions, economic development and sustainability and equity in one. So we're trying to find ways to bring them together in a governance model to consider, again, countywide resiliency planning where we can, where it's feasible, health impact assessments, and we'd like to extend the roles of regional planning councils, since they have proven themselves adept at delivering clean energy and climate smart services in the past. Next slide, please. And here's where we get to some of the governance issues. How do we designate priority development and priority conservation areas? Well, we should be doing that on an interagency level. We should be bringing these worlds together, land use, ecology, community development. And we think that there's an opportunity now as kind of a next step in the state's movement towards regionalism to do that on the regional level and, again, align the missions, maybe even the geographies where we can, of the different players. And that's where I think more intermunicipal agreements, intermunicipal shared planning and zoning could really help. Next slide. The HCR, Housing and Community Renewal, has established transit-oriented development / workforce housing as a priority state goal in one of their programs. And it's a nice model. We would like to see that expanded. It'd be nice to see it in other agencies too. And on the same note, BOA is very much a emblematic of what we're trying to do with this statute, the equity, the sustainability, the redevelopment, the just transition components. So considering extending what is already in statute, a priority and preference in funding for delineated programs, we could expand those programs and really get to projects quickly, because many of these BOAs have delivered plans, certainly, but shovel-ready projects. And is there a way, this is a constant theme, to pilot interdisciplinary mini-grant programs, quick targeted outcomes, test balloons, maybe get a little risky with these and try out some new things? We've mentioned at one meeting the pilot program that the Hudson River Estuary did in Red Hook and Tivoli, and it was really an example of what we're trying to do here with priority growth and priority conservation areas on the municipal level. Next slide, please. Building off the last one, you know, we coined this term, this phrase in this process, plan to zone, and really it's an effort to move the process along more quickly, to get plans, maybe to do zoning simultaneously or immediately after in areas that can't do very expensive and expansive plans. We have recommendations for regional coordinators to help them, but also to do maybe what they do in Tug Hill, which is the mini comp plan light, bare bones. Get your plan, get your community input, and move right to zoning and projects, because the statute and the state of affairs of climate change compel and urgency. And there are plenty of case studies out there, particularly in rural counties and communities, where counties and other regional entities have moved this process rather quickly. Next slide, please. It's kind of repetitive, but expedited mini comp plans, district plans, where you may not want to start by doing a full municipal wide comp plan or county wide comp plan. District plans, overlay zonings, we've talked about those in the past. They can be very targeted and very surgical and very effective. But we'd have to develop some base criteria, some clear state goals that we want to see in these comp plans if we're going to assist these communities. And very important emerging topic here is baseline data for municipalities. Sometimes that's an obstacle for them to do good planning. They just don't know how to compile the data or where to find it. So we're talking about some type of centralized portal for them. Next slide, please.
Paul, can I interrupt for 1 second?
Of course.
Just before we move on, I just don't want to, it's a lot of dense slides. So I just wanted to give folks an opportunity before we go into the second two recommendations. Is there anything on the first two that anyone wants to bring up or discuss or ask? If not, just move on. I just wanted to open it up for that. Hearing nothing. Okay. Nope. Go ahead, Paul. Just to open up the floor for a second.
Okay, and this is where we're trying to get to the process of project review and potentially move it along. Assist, jumpstart is the phrase we've used, maybe by providing some assistance for GEISs in areas that are adhering to certain threshold criteria of smart growth, sustainability, and equity. We talked a lot about pre-development community outreach, particularly by developers, but also assisted by the state and the locality. That seems to move the process along when you get way out ahead in front of projects and do real community outreach and education. In some cases, developers have done that door to door. And now there's so many graphic technical tools available to communicate more effectively about smart growth, density, affordability, those controversial aspects of smart growth. Looking at Massachusetts statutes, they seem to be working pretty well, and we have several case studies throughout the state of how that works. Just figure out how to expedite it and help, again, going back to the first meeting we had, What are you doing right in the localities? How have we helped you, and how can we help you even more? Next slide. We're getting into the Smart Growth Infrastructure Act. There's an opportunity there to dig in and give it the teeth that we were unable to implant in it 10 years ago. But certainly with the statute, we can squeeze a lot in. We can get to prioritizing smart growth-inducing infrastructure, disincentivizing new sprawl-inducing infrastructure. And I think that might be a good place to statutorily define and establish what we mean by priority development and conservation areas. And we got to look more closely at you know, some of the options for financial and technical assistance for these GEISs, for the zoning. And next slide, I think, gets right to that. Okay, this is a little bit repetitive. Pre-development outreach, really important. Again, the sensitive topic that I think is at least worth discussing. Is there a way to set some criteria for the model equitable, sustainable, smart project or zoning, and then try to move it through the CEQA process more quickly, either a presumptive neg deck or a type 2 listing, or again, bullet number one, maybe some Uber scoping, Uber early, Uber expansive scoping and outreach. Next slide. Self-explanatory. This kind of encapsulates everything we're doing, planning and zoning, project review to get to implementation of plans and zoning. Again, plenty of opportunities out there on the regional level for assistance in that regard. Next slide. Yeah, and here we get to the meat of the matter here. You know, there are entities out there that are already doing what we're talking about, and maybe they can do it more in the area of land use and zoning, with smart growth at DOS, DEC climate leadership, and we have NYSERDA clean energy coordinators. And in building on that, maybe as a resource, the idea of a digital handbook or guide to help folks navigate the maze of state programs to connect them. And in our last discussion, we talked a little bit more about actually revising programs, looking deep into them, updating them, altering the programs to make them individually and collectively more easy to access and understand. These two are key, I think, to so many of the other strategies, initiatives, excuse me. Next slide. And here again, a centralized repository of data. Heard that from communities, that would really help. The IDAs are playing a significant role in clean energy and downtown redevelopment and infill and smart growth. And they've been a willing partner with us. So maybe we could expand upon what they're doing on a patchwork and proliferate it throughout the state. Take a closer look at 239, section 239, that's county review of certain municipal planning and projects. Might be good to get a put a little more teeth into that statute to get a more of a regional multi-municipal lens. And then the issue, which is in the statute and in our analyses of distressed, disadvantaged communities, and that is, how do you do this without displacement and gentrification? And we're looking into some shared community-centered ownership, shared equity models under the banner of community wealth building. Next slide. And that is all. Any questions?
Uh-huh.
Okay, thanks everyone.
Wait. Stand up.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did.
Sorry, I didn't see that.
Could you go back? I think it's two slides, and specifically the recommendation regarding the coordinators. And yes, as someone who is overseeing development of the RFP for the climate leadership coordinators, a comment that I think Ed made last meeting resonated with me about the fact that and Ed can correct me if I'm overstating this or misstating it, that essentially that there is planning expertise at the regional and local level. And it's, and I don't think he said this, but it's almost presumptuous of us to say that we're going to provide technical assistance to these professional planners who are in these county and municipal planning boards. So if, and I think you went back one too far. Yep. But I guess my real point is, should we explore that some more and perhaps be more specific about what the state in the form of these coordinators can actually do that would be helpful?
Sure.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I don't know if Ed's trying to talk or if he's able to talk. I know he was having issues earlier. I think we had talked about that the coordinators aren't necessarily the right ones to be delivering planning and zoning technical assistance because they really have a really high. And also we were kind of pushing the envelope. I think Jessica and others about do we take these programs and potentially simplify them and combine them, especially particularly the NYSERDA and the DEC two programs. And I don't see that really reflected in here. We're expanding them, but we're not streamlining them, which is something to discuss.
That definitely came up. And I think, I can't remember now which slide it was, but I just mentioned where at the Monday meeting that we're talking about not just connecting and clarifying the programs, but actually going into them. And the word alter was used, revise, to make the individual programs a little bit more comprehensible.
Ed, I think you're unmuted on my end. So if you want to try unmuting on your end and see if you wanted to make a comment, I think you're okay to go. Okay, we may still be having some issues, but we will work on that. Sorry about that, Ed.
Can you hear me now?
All right. Yeah.
Okay. I don't have anything much to add other than I think that the regional coordinators might still be able to play a navigating role in terms of state planning programs successful. But I think the function of doing the planning, there are a lot of levels of planning at those county and local level, and the consultants that come and work with municipalities to do that work as well.
Yeah, Mark, I think to your point that's a point well made. I don't think we have the people coming in and actually doing the plans, more as you use the phrase navigator, handholder, capacity builder. There are some entities that have done exactly that. They've walked municipalities through their plan, but it's not as if they write it like a consultant. They're just getting folks through the process. And several of the coordinators out there are actually regional planning councils, and they seem to be the ones that have risen to the top. Central New York, Finger Lakes, that brood. Anybody else? Okay, thanks.
Paul, Laura had a comment in the chat that you might be interested in.
Okay.
Before you saw it.
Laura, do you want to just unmute and?
Sure. I was just going to make the point that rather than blanket statement about helping municipalities, just to Mark's question, just can we specify assisting willing communities? That's kind of the approach we've taken in the estuary watershed, because while some have paid planners on staff, many of them don't, or if they do, that's very limited. And they're just really present for meetings or some prep for some planning and zoning board meetings, but they're not really there to advise on larger concepts of smart growth or priority conservation areas or that sort of thing.
Yep. Okay.
Thank you.
Just, we have to remember, again, for those like Brad and I who are putting together the RFPs for these kinds of things, I'm pretty sure that, for instance, the climate leadership RFP that we're getting ready, and I don't think the clean energy community's RFP asked, for instance, for certified planners. And so, yes, in fact, the planning commissions have done well at competing for those contracts, but it's not guaranteed. And we'd have to think about, you know, is this a skill that we want to require of future bidders? And is it an actual, you know, the actual planning, is it something that the state wants to actually provide?
Yeah.
Well, I think to that end, if, you know, that's where sort of this becomes a, I want to use the word triage, but that's not the word I'm looking for, a sort of first, you know, a point of first, a one-stop shop that then can direct to, you know, direct to other resources within the state. So, for example, you know, at, you know, planning is, you know, we do have planning expertise at Department of State. So, you know, in our Office of Local Government Services, also in our Office of Planning and Smart Growth. So this is, you know, this is an opportunity, not, you know, we don't want to duplicate services, but we want to sort of centralize. And I think that's sort of the message here, is providing that sort of simple, easy, one-stop shop for communities, and somebody who can go out and, you know, and that point of contact. And it may not be that person or that, you know, that point of contact has the expertise, but they're able to direct them and help them access what they need.
I do want to make the point that, you know, these are small planning boards, town boards that have a lot of turnover. And one of the things that the commission provides is some historical, you know, information as people change over. And by having the planning function stay with some kind of governmental entity, the county, a regional planning organization that's going to be there and doing planning well into the future, you can be that conduit to keep things moving forward in communities. So when a board changes over, you're not starting from scratch. You have the institutional memory to keep them moving forward. So I just offer that as we kind of continue to debate where the planning function really should be.
Yeah.
Absolutely, Katie. And I think we are talking about, you know, a partnership, right? I mean, at all levels and acknowledging that the players may be different, the partners may be different in different areas, but that we need to be, you know, there needs to be a system that is nimble and comprehensive enough to be able to bring in all of the partners. And I think you're absolutely right. Build the capacity, the local capacity and the regional capacity. All right. Anything else for Paul? Or on land use for anyone else on the land, you know, who's anyone, any other panel members have anything to add, anything missing, needs to be changed, et cetera, et cetera? Oh, okay. All right, then let's move on to clean energy. Brad, I will hand the mic over to you.
Thanks, Sarah. So let me just start by saying thank you to all the clean energy subgroup members and other panelists who have contributed to some of these recommendations. You know, thank you everybody for your time. We know that it's hard to make time, and so we really appreciate the contributions. Next slide. So there's been some wordsmithing, some streamlining, some shortening of the recommendations, initiatives. So you'll see that reflected in some of the words have changed slightly. But what we have here is a recommendation to develop a statewide dashboard of community greenhouse gas emissions inventories, really to promote local climate action planning, but also to monitor equity considerations, measure progress, and really create a consistent metrics across counties, municipalities, towns, cities, villages. So we have a consistency in the way that this data is reported so that, you know, any local government in the state effectively can go online and pull up what's the carbon footprint of my community, what are the different components of it. And there are probably different ways that we can incorporate, you know, various considerations like equity, but also to generate like actionable ideas for local governments to consider in terms of what they can do to reduce their carbon footprint and really to inform, you know, that kind of local decision making and kind of put it into context of what the likely impact is, the likely cost potentially, but also the likely impact of various climate actions. So this is programmatic and regulatory. There's some examples like the Utility Energy Registry where the state actually requires utilities, the regulated utilities around the state, to report electricity and natural gas use by jurisdiction. And so we have a nifty kind of map website where you can go and you can get that data. But there's still some areas of data that we need to do the carbon footprint related to transportation, related to fuels, that are still missing, you know. So part of this recommendation is kind of develop more of a comprehensive view of the carbon footprint. The Slope platform, as well as ICLEI ClearPath software, you know, these are just examples of some of the dashboards or tools that exist out there that help communities do this kind of planning. Next slide. And again, developing data reporting protocols is really important. And this recommendation here just includes that suppliers of fuels should be reporting at the community level, or at least the county level, to the greatest extent practicable. And if so, and if not practicable, then perhaps there could be protocols and methodologies to compile this data in a way that's useful for local governments. And that speaks also to this kind of notion of transportation models to estimate vehicle miles traveled at the county, city, town, and village level. You know, this is really important. What's the carbon footprint of transportation in my community? Well, that's like a direct reflection of how many vehicle miles traveled are there. And there are models, transportation models, that help to estimate that at the local government level. And so that's part of it. And then launch and maintain this dashboard, ensuring that it's really accessible to everyone, that it's easy to use, that it makes sense, and that includes relevant information, and that it's not just like a litany of complicated and confusing data. It's actually, you know, really geared towards action on the local government level. Next slide. So here we're talking really about energy efficiency and, you know, the notion that local governments are always kind of adopting policies, right? And they volunteer to adopt those policies. And so what can we do to kind of encourage them to adopt, sort of like to demonstrate their leadership by adopting things like stretch energy codes, being like one cycle ahead of the code updates that are happening in terms of the energy code? There are things that they can do in terms of streamlined permitting and enhanced code enforcement, third-party inspections, shared enforcement, but also like financing policies like PACE financing. So we can provide support to local governments, especially those that struggle with tight budgets and limited staff, with different kinds of support to help make these things happen, make it really achievable, you know, which is a key component of this. A lot of local governments say, well, I'd like to do that, but, you know, it's not really something that we have the staff capacity to do. We really don't have the budget to be exploring kind of anything but the more core functions of local government. And so thank you very much. You know, but we think that there are opportunities to do more to encourage local governments to take that step and to do something to really demonstrate their leadership. And there are some state programs that exist that are good models or case studies. Next slide. And again, you know, the Clean Energy Communities, Climate Smart Communities programs, They really are encouraging and guiding local climate action across the state. And these are really flexible programs in that, you know, they evolve over time to incorporate the latest and greatest, the most impactful, you know, whatever it's going to take to achieve that next level of impact. They can kind of help local governments take those steps, and over time it can change and evolve. And I will say that the clean energy communities and climate smart communities programs do appeal to different segments of the sort of market of local governments in the state. And they are very integrated in the sense that, you know, climate smart community certification is a high impact action under our clean energy communities program. And likewise, to get certified as a climate smart community, they'll give you credit for most every action you take under the clean energy communities program. So it's sort of to say that, you know, they're very complementary. They do appeal to different segments of the market. And we think that, you know, as much as it makes sense to kind of combine them, we think that there might be a negative impact in that it just would be a smaller overall opportunity. If they're two separate programs appealing to a large, you know, separate segments, we might get more impact. So it's just something to consider, you know, what is the outcome that we're trying to achieve? So it's just something to consider in terms of the two programs. But also NYPA's program is out there. You know, they've got clean energy services. We coordinate very closely with NYPA as well, in terms of these regional coordinators are meeting with NYPA reps to talk about the kinds of services that are available to help communities make their facilities more energy efficient, to build large solar installations, to convert streetlights to LEDs. There's a number of things that NYPA is geared up to do to help kind of swoop in and reduce your carbon footprint at the local government level. We think that those could be continued and expanded to reach even more communities. And again, the regional coordinator network, you know, these folks really make those connections. They're not going to do all the work for the local government, but they are true coordinators in that they're going to make available the different state programs to that local government. And what we've heard from local governments is, you know, we don't want to be inundated by, you know, 5 to 10 different state reps trying to call us to get involved in their program. We really want to have a sort of a liaison to state programs that, you know, is a trusted local partner, regional partner that can help get us where we want to go. But it's important to take into consideration, and this is part of the clean energy communities and climate smart communities programs, it's much more than just technical assistance. You know, you've got clear guidance. We're telling the local governments, here are good things for you to do in a very clear, you know, easy to understand language. So clear guidance. We're providing technical support. So these regional coordinators who like work and live in the regions they serve, they're trusted local partners. They're going to help provide the guidance to navigating these programs. Plus, you've got grants, okay? So that's motivating local governments to participate. And then they're being recognized for their leadership on clean energy. And we find that that's a real important mix of benefits, that local governments are really encouraged and motivated to take action on climate change as a result of. So it's a kind of a whole package. Next slide. And please interrupt me if you want to ask any questions or provide any comments.
Actually, Brad, can I interrupt you? It's Sarah again. Just back to the last slide just for a second. I think this ties in with, and this is where I was talking about earlier, that there is overlap between the subgroups. And I just wanted to flag that this is where we really do see sort of an overarching need for just, you know, and where these recommendations are talking about really being that, you know, providing that point that then directs and helps communities access programs across the state. So not just, you know, that the regional coordinator network would not just be saying, oh, here's, you know, this is how our NYSERDA programs work, or this is the DEC program, but this is how to access NYPA. This is where HCR could come into play. This is where DOS has a program, you know, so that's sort of the, I think that goes back to the discussion we were having in the land use section. So I just wanted to flag that.
Thanks, Sarah. Okay.
Thank you, Brad.
Okay, so I think we may end up flipping these two, putting number three in front of number two, just to kind of start by saying we can move towards a sort of a, you know, consistent statewide policies to support local code enforcement by aligning like the energy code with CLCPA goals, establishing energy benchmarking and performance standards for buildings, creating innovative public benefit financing mechanisms. You know, these are sort of statewide approaches to make local government more consistent across the board, so that there isn't sort of a patchwork of different policies, but that we are really consistent in moving statewide policies forward, and that will be supported by local enforcement. So, and there are some examples of sort of local laws or reports that point to the role of local government with respect to ensuring the effectiveness of these statewide policies. Next slide. And then just to get into, you know, some of the details, again, establishing these kinds of statewide standards through legislation, aligning the energy code with CLCPA goals. There are some specifics with respect to changes in the energy law that would allow for the energy code to advance more quickly because of the way in which cost effectiveness is evaluated and societal effects, reduction of carbon emissions, et cetera. This is a, you know, very practical recommendation with respect to providing financial support for administrative costs that code enforcement offices incur with respect to purchasing of code books and guidance documents and training. Consider programs also for municipal-based financing to require decarbonization of building, to create financing programs at the state level that complement local decarbonization mandates or requirements. So what this is sort of getting at is just the way that we finance clean water improvements, that there may be a way to develop a similar financing model to support decarbonization of buildings. Next slide. Again, this is really about siting. We want to promote the deployment of clean energy, to expand equitable access, to maximize local economic benefits, minimize the environmental impacts of siting through planning support, provision of model local laws, streamline permitting, local development regulations. And, you know, here's the key. Let's find ways to identify as-of-right installation opportunities for certain clean energy technologies, but also a reasonable process for installations that aren't as of right. And that's kind of a nice way of moving the ball forward, to have the right processes in place so that we're anticipating and planning for the development of clean energy in our communities. And there's some great examples of like the Scenic Hudson solar mapping tool or this Long Island solar roadmap that we encourage you to look at, because they're really opening up, to put on a map, where are the transmission lines, where are the substations, where are the agricultural soils, where is it even feasible to build solar? You realize that the whole town isn't going to get covered in solar panels. It's only going to be in certain areas. And this kind of mapping and this kind of planning really helps to identify these opportunities and put everybody on the same page of why it makes sense to put a project in a certain place. Yes?
I see Mark has his hand up. I don't know if he meant to.
Yeah, thank you, Sarah. Could you go back to number three, please? I think it's just one slide back. Brad, I don't know what factors are included in the energy law in the way it specifies how to address cost effectiveness. Is it just a matter of dollars expended, dollars saved?
Now, I tell you, Mark, I'm not necessarily an expert in exactly what the energy law says, but my understanding is that there is a measure of cost effectiveness, and it needs to be less than 10 years. And that's a limiting factor in terms of how far you can push the energy code. And so, you know, just extending that 10-year period, you know, was seen as a potential solution. But I, you know, in my work on the stretch energy code, I mean, we do look at, you know, what are the upfront costs, you know, the incremental costs of building to that new standard versus how much energy is it going to save over time. And, you know, that's a cost effectiveness measure that's used. Now, the energy law, that's a legal question. I don't want to necessarily get into it.
Well, I'm only thinking, can we consider recommending that the energy law be amended so that it allows for incorporation of the social cost of carbon? Which is going to make it even more expensive.
That fits under secondary and societal effects. I will also mention that this is exactly aligned with the energy efficiency work group, that they put in a very similar recommendation, and you know, they are staffed with experts in the energy code and how it's assessed, so we kind of coordinated on making sure that these two align, but that being said, I mean, certainly the social cost of carbon is something that we can consider.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, next slide. So, you know, we have some success at NYSERDA with promoting local laws that provide these kind of development regulations or, you know, models that are supported with all kinds of documentation and pictures and maps and really good guidance on, you know, what model local laws are intended to do and best practices, et cetera. So that's one piece. Streamlining the solar permitting process at the local level is another thing we've had a lot of success doing and we can continue to do. Developing additional tools and resources like the mapping that we're talking about is going to really help communities take that next step to maximize those benefits for the community. And minimize negative impacts on things like high quality soils or other competing uses. And then we come back to this idea of providing technical assistance, but also financial support to just help local governments plan for and review these solar projects. So there's a lot that can be done in that respect. Next slide. Here.
I had a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Brad, this is Ed. On that last slide, one thing I hadn't thought to mention before, but we may want to just include in the number of things that we could do modeling for, is solar access. As places urbanize more and develop, and as we try to green communities with more tree planting, this whole issue of access to solar energy becomes a conflict point potentially. I know it was in Ithaca at a couple projects. So that would be something where there was guidance on that. That would be helpful too to include. Also on the code enforcement, there has been some discussion in some counties, and it's actually occurred in other counties, of countywide code enforcement to bring more consistency to it. And it is a shared service option. That might be something the state could facilitate where there's interest.
Yeah, and that is directly included in, I think it was strategy 3, where we talk about shared code enforcement models. You know, the county model. There are several counties. I don't know if it's fair to say several, but a handful of counties in the state that the local government ceded their authority to provide code enforcement, and you know, if you think about it, you know, how many dozens of towns, each with their own code enforcement officer, each with their own, you know, vehicle to drive around and their own office, you know, to support. And, you know, you could have like a lot of people working in code enforcement versus a you know, kind of a centralized county approach where there are maybe fewer people and it's more concentrated and the training, et cetera, is done. So those kinds of shared models, you know, could save a lot of money, but also provide for more effective code enforcement. But again, it's, you know, there's different ways it's done and different preferences. And like you said, for those who are willing. Next slide.
Brad?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Laura.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Just to follow Sarah's lead in connecting the dots between the different recommendations, I brought up the idea of this need for a centralized portal of good baseline data. And Brad, you brought up the Hudson or the Scenic Hudson solar mapping tool. And I think, you know, the reason that's useful is because of all of the considerations regarding everything, like you said, soils and agriculture, forests, you know, what natural resources might be impacted. I think getting to that idea of priority development areas, priority conservation areas, I'm hoping that this baseline data could include a lot of those kinds of natural resource layers that also should be considered in comp plans, as well as solar siting. I just feel like there's a real one-stop shop opportunity here to cross bridge these different priorities and these different recommendations and make it easier on municipalities to access. Because right now that solar tool, there's one for Long Island, there's one for the Hudson Valley, but it's still in these regions where it would be so great if there was that kind of statewide opportunity for baseline data clearinghouse.
Yeah, and ones that are really so thoughtful and, you know, easy to understand, they guide you through it and really well supported. I mean, that's Scenic Hudson has done these webinars and stuff, and you watch it and you realize, I mean, it's just really well done. And if we could replicate that at a statewide level, I mean, that would certainly be a great outcome. Anything else?
Well, my point was sort of related in that there are all these regional efforts going on, in particular the solar mappers. And I'm wondering if by the time the state gets around to actually providing similar projects, we'll have 7 or 8 regional products already out there. And it may be that it's more useful for us to try to coordinate, be a facilitator and a coordinator, than just say, okay, the state's going to do it. And we end up having all these regional entities investing, and then the state comes in and does the same thing, only different. Can we recognize that people are already thinking about doing this and in some cases jump on the back of the train because the regions are already ahead of us, ahead of the state?
And doing almost like a gap analysis to see, you know, where are the tools existing, where are the higher quality, or where's there a need because the tools are there, but they're not that good, or they just don't exist. That might be a way to time out the implementation of this along with what's already out there.
Yep.
Good point.
Yeah, and there are different needs in different regions that could be addressed. You know, obviously Long Island is actually a very different, you know, place in the Hudson Valley with respect to the kind of mapping tool that would be most relevant. And then different utilities have made data available, you know, differently, you know, so it is not a one size fits all approach. So that has to, like you're saying, a gap analysis, or, you know, really think that through.
Or maybe even the technical assistance is finding what are the best tools that are out there, where is there a need, and then how do you replicate? You know, thinking of our Hudson Valley Natural Resource Mapper, it's really just taking statewide data sets for the most part and putting them all in one place for municipalities to access. So that means that could be replicated other parts of the state. It's just a matter of creating the how-to and some technical assistance, maybe a little funding to be able to broaden that out either statewide, but that could all be part of that baseline clearinghouse of information. That includes, I guess, what Paul was getting at is some of the socioeconomic information for comp plans, as well as the natural resource information for comp plans and solar siting. It's all, you know, so compatible, so helpful.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot. I think you're all right. There's a lot out there. So the gap analysis is certainly a good start. And if I don't know if I've shared with you all, if anyone wants to check out the Department of State's map GIS gateway, actually does that, pulls in data, mapping data, geographic data from a variety of sources, both state, federal, and private, that can sort of be viewed together. So that could be, you know, sort of a template or model for the type of ultimately the type of access that, you know, the type of platform that might work.
So initiative number five is really about getting out into the community and encouraging, you know, sort of constituents to adopt clean energy products, services, get involved with job opportunities. There are a number of things that we can kind of help do that by adopting things like CCA programs, microgrids, district systems, having workforce development initiatives, community sale campaigns. You know, these things are intended to really generate value and savings for customers in an equitable manner. And there's a lot that could be done to kind of encourage, you know, what is like a sort of a process of you know adoption, you know. So many of these clean energy technologies like hardly existed, you know, a few years ago, things like LEDs, electric vehicles, solar panels even. And now, you know, more and more people are aware of them, more and more people are incorporating them into their homes, businesses, and community institutions. And there's a lot that the state can do to sort of encourage local governments, but also through state programs, policies, regulations, sort of move that process even further and see higher levels of adoption. So that's what this initiative is all about. Next slide. So CCA programs, this is where local government officials can choose where the energy comes from for their communities. There is a suggestion that these local governments, you know, can automatically enroll their constituents into community distributed generation. So there's a lot of technical acronyms and things here, but what we're talking about here is just in mass enrolling people in like community solar subscriptions. This is possible through CCA programs. It's being demonstrated in two communities that have been approved for it, Brockport and Lima. But we think that this type of policy has extraordinary potential, because instead of going door to door trying to encourage somebody to you know, adopt a community solar subscription, the local government officials are making the decision, you know, this fits with our community values, let's enroll our constituents in mass into these, get a savings on their utility bills, and if they don't like it for whatever reason, they can drop out without any fee or penalty. So that's what that first bullet is about. The recommendation here is to enable county governments to authorize and form CCA programs with a local opt-out. So if local governments don't want to participate, they don't have to, but that the county government, instead of going, you know, to all these different local governments trying to put together a CCA, if it fit with the local, you know, the priorities of the county government to establish a CCA program, that they could do so. Promoting community scale campaigns like Solarize, but really covering a broad range of technologies, whether that's community solar or electric vehicles or demand response technologies. There's lots of different ways that we can use campaigns to generate value and savings for customers. Workforce development focused on training and job placement in the clean energy and emerging technologies, and also, you know, to address equity considerations as well. And then microgrids, either in municipal, school, private settings, district clean energy systems, you know, these are sort of, you know, depends on a lot of technical feasibility, legal feasibility, you know, financial feasibility, but where appropriate, microgrids and district energy systems can also do a lot in terms of moving the needle and making those resources, clean energy, available and accessible to more people in New York State. Next. And lastly, this is an initiative all about local government operations and, you know, energy consuming assets that local governments and other related public entities control, whether that's like lighting, street lighting, wastewater treatment plants, buildings. Maybe there's a landfill that you're going to put solar panels on. Maybe you've got a school district with a large bus fleet that you could electrify. What we're trying to do with this last initiative is really to try to move the needle on all those energy consuming assets controlled by local governments and related public entities. And so there's some examples of programs that are helpful to try to, you know, move those efforts along. Next slide. Again, another theme is, you know, local governments benefit a lot from this technical support, especially from these regional coordinators, trusted local partners. But we have to expand also into these related public entities, because I don't think that they've been as much a part of the conversation as they should be. Although there are programs that address them, there's a lot of like wastewater treatment, like authorities or parking authorities or, you know, there's a lot of special purpose governments in New York State. Each one, you know, many of them rather have energy consuming assets. If we're always talking to the local government, we may miss a few of those public entities. But evaluating options to reduce interconnection costs for municipally owned priority sites, prioritizing funding to recover methane from wastewater treatment and landfills for energy production, developing tools and resources to help local governments purchase energy directly for their local governments and other community stakeholders, supporting the electrification of fleets, tracking and reporting the energy use of municipal buildings, increasing waste reduction and recycling, both in municipal operations and in the community. Next slide. I think that is it. So if you have any questions or comments on the clean energy subgroup work, again, thank you for your time. I appreciate any feedback you might have.
Anyone have anything else for Brad? Okay, thank you, Brad. And I do see we've got some robust conversation, a bunch of comments coming in the chat. Want to reassure everybody we're receiving them. There's some really good ideas here. We'll definitely be integrating those into our discussions in the coming weeks. Please continue to submit additional comments either in the chat or through the email address that we have. Right. Okay. So let's, we have just about 15 minutes left. Let's use that time to talk about next steps. So we talked about a lot of this before. We talked about the adaptation and resilience recommendations, that timeline. Because that's on an extended timeline, we do have our upcoming public comment, official public meeting on March 8th. That'll follow our panel meeting. But that meeting will focus primarily on the sort of areas that we focused on after adaptation resilience, so carbon sequestration, land use, and clean energy recommendations will be the focus of that meeting. For panel members, I know Priya had to jump off a little bit early, but she has been particularly, she's volunteered to help us structure the public meeting. So we'll be talking in the next couple of days about that. Anyone else who wants to participate in that, do let me know. But March 8th, especially for those of you on, you know, participating, March 8th is going to be our public meeting. We will post, I think someone asked in the chat about being able to see recommendations prior to that meeting. We will post the latest drafts together with that meeting as it gets closer. They're not up yet simply because the version, you know, we don't have a version yet to post, but we will post, we will be posting sort of draft recommendations at that prior to the meeting so that folks can review them. We'll also be talking about them at the meeting too, so there'll be plenty of opportunity to see what you're commenting on, but we really look forward to hearing from everyone then. Again, the public comment, I don't think we need to, I've said several times about public engagement, so let's move along then to the next and last slide, which is our schedule. And we have gone over this, but we have another adaptation and subgroup meeting on the 25th. March 1st is the next carbon sequestration subgroup meeting. March 3rd, we have a cross panel discussion with Power Gen and Ag and Forestry on clean energy deployment. We'll talk some more about those sort of cross-cutting issues. I hope that as many of you as possible can join that discussion. Another Adaptation Resilience Subcommittee meeting on the 4th. And we will, the other subgroups don't have, land use and clean energy don't have something on the calendar now, but I think we'll be setting those up in the next day or so. So that's for the subgroups, and we do have, that's leading up to our next panel meeting and public engagement session on March 8th. But prior to that, March 2nd is our second local officials roundtable. That'll take place on March 2nd. It is open to the public to join as attendees, similarly to these panel meetings. But I hope that all the panel members will be able to attend, and look forward to sort of sharing that where we have gotten with the local officials that participated the first time around, and get their feedback and advice as we sort of move to finalizing the recommendations that we'll deliver to the Climate Action Council. After we do, you know, after we'll have the local officials roundtable, we'll have the panel meeting on the 8th. After we hear the public engagement, we'll sort of circle back with a final meeting, a final meeting in March, sort of late March, to talk about how we've integrated all the feedback that we received in the beginning of March into our recommendations. I just wanted to flag also that on February 26th, that's this Friday, I believe. Is it this Friday? There is the next Climate Action Council meeting at 3 p.m. Always a good idea to join those if you can, to see where the Climate Action Council is. That is, by the way, Friday. I just opened my calendar. But I recommend that folks do join that to see what the Climate Action Council is up to on the 26th. The login information is on the climate.ny.gov website, and let me know if you have trouble finding it. So that's all. That's sort of the end of our official agenda. Is there anything anyone wants to add? Any questions, comments before we adjourn?
Hey, Sarah, it's Kathy. When you post some of the draft recommendations, do you usually send us panelists a specific link so we know to go look for it ahead of meetings?
We can do that. Yeah, we'll do that.
That'd be great. That's really helpful.
Yeah. And we can send you the document as well. Okay. Hearing nothing either. Yes, we've done it for today. We're good. Okay. Thank you all very much. Appreciate all of your continued, I know everybody on here is volunteer, and you all have other jobs. So really, really, really appreciate the time and effort that the panel members have put into this, that the members of the public who joined, and I see there are a lot of folks who are on meeting after meeting, really appreciate your time. This is this is a big effort, but it's really important. So thank you all very much. Have a great afternoon. See you all soon.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.